Kind of second thought on that, I mean, when I say second engine or third engine, you need, it could be interrupted. We're starting to talk about this, we'll be like soldering, let's see what we're talking about. Why, what is the argument to, why do you, zero would be that worse than the 64? National Command Center, two minutes, what have you.
Mr. President?
I think I know, but I just want to be sure I've heard.
From a military standpoint, it is difficult to defend the two-site proposal. The two-site proposal can be defended on the basis that it can be expanded for a 12-site program. We have tabled a proposition in Seoul, which gives the Soviet certainly an advantage as far as the long-term is concerned on the offensive weapon systems. If we were to give up the capability which we have to go into a defensive system on down the road by going to zero at this time without opening up the offensive proposition that we put on the table in the salt box, I believe it would be endanger our security planning. And so the position of the chief and the position that I've taken is that no, do not table the zero at this time unless you're willing also at the same time to make a reduction as far as the offensive limitations are concerned.
Then if you do that, you have, it makes plenty of things down the drain, and we are right back to where we started from last January if we're in a comprehensive negotiation.
Henry, it depends on what date you attach to the May 20th operation.
And whether or not in the offensive side you put into it an automatic date by which you have freedom to mix if they have to come to a permanent.
Right, but then what this will lead us to, if it's a possible way of going, is towards the comprehensive agreement in which all the offensive and defensive weapons are included. What we had attempted to do on May 20th was to make an AVN limitation and a temporary offensive limitation which would act as a bridge to a more comprehensive one. So what Mel is proposing could be incorporated in the second stage of the negotiation. That is to say, we could then keep the zero AVN for the second stage of the negotiation, couple it with offensive reductions. I agree with the chiefs and with Mel. I think, however, that if we want a rapid agreement, we've got to stick with the May 20th framework.
You agree we should stick with
the 20th. Yes, but I had some problems, and I had some problems, Mr. President, with the date that's been used in this in 17 and this in 20, because it does give the Soviet Union, if this becomes the only agreement we have, and we have to look at it from the standpoint we might not get anything else, it gives them an opportunity of having a superior force in 74 and 75, and I don't want to be around to see the Soviet Union ever be in a position of superiority. I can accept parity, but I think that this particular proposition, if we don't follow through on something else, gives them the opportunity for superiority. I think that's the position of the chiefs, too.
Right, that's what will happen if the interim agreement turns out to be the final agreement.
But there is a provision which is that if there is no permanent agreement, the whole thing becomes subject to abrogation after
you. Henry, my problem is this, that I think it's going to be most difficult for the United States to set aside the agreement. I think it's easier for the Soviet Union to set aside an agreement because of the manner of our whole system of government. It's much more difficult for us to set aside the agreement than it is for the Soviet Union.
Well, the difficulty with zero AVM, just a simple point, zero AVM plus a freeze, basically. And that's what it is on their offensive thing, means that we freeze ourselves in an inferior position both ways.
Right.
That's correct.
Right.
That's why I'm also. That's right. So that is why we can, under no circumstance, let's continue to agree on that line. That clear
that that's not good message.
We must say that was never the understanding. We have nothing about freeze ourselves. Because all we can do is say, all right, we won't have any AVM. But you look at those charts, we're already inferior.
accepted numbers, of course, of the lands, because of Irving, which we may have in maybe 4 or 5 years if somebody does not cut out. So we don't want to freeze right now, right?
This is right, Dave.
You see, we don't want to do that zero ATM.
Exactly. If you have zero ATM in the context of the May 20th deal, we are freezing ourselves into a second position, an inferior position. Right?
That's right.
And I might add, sir, we're freezing in
every way. We have a lead in technology. Go ahead, Ben.
Yes, sir. So my shorthand term for this appropriate conventional power is relative power. On chart 6, I show you examples of where I believe power was held and used successfully or was relevant. In the left-hand column, I list those where it was successful. Sea power includes the Marines, of course, with their three division air wing teams. We could add appreciably to the list on the left. The list on the right is shorter because decision actors normally calculate the expected outcome, and hence they find other paths or back down as these three had to appear. And any president's options will, of course, depend on whether he possesses the relevant power. Now, on chart number 7, I show you how I think relevant power is shifting. In line 1, for example, the terms threat, nuclear attack, and the X under the column titled strategic nuclear forces shows these forces were exclusively relevant in the 50s and 60s, as discussed. The nuclear balance now makes this threat unlikely. Although in ending World War II and President Truman's threat to Stalin to get him out of Iran, they were relevant. Lines 2 to 4 show Europe, the shift in the threat from the NATO center in the 50s and 60s. Line 2, to NATO northern and southern flanks, line 3 and 4. The greater stability in the center is due to the perceived linkage of nuclear weapons to conventional forces, to unrest in the Warsaw Pact, to Russia's concern about the Chinese communist border forces. The instability on the NATO flanks is due to Soviet flanking movements, increased strength of the Soviet fleet. I just come back from a 7-country trip through Central and Northern Europe. I found not only the chiefs of Navy, but the chiefs of defense staff of all of those countries had that perception, and in many cases, the ministries of defense. In essence, they see Finland becoming a Latvia, Sweden becoming a Finland, and Norway, within 5 years, becoming a Sweden. Lines 5 and 6 show Asia, where the Nixon doctrine implies a shift from the large-scale U.S. ground involvement in Asia of the 50s and 60s, line 5, to a strategy, line 6 of the 70s, in which we provide help to an ally, as in the case of the countries listed. Lines 7 through 12 show other types of situations in which the nature shifts from one in which strategic and land-based forces are relevant, such as Cuba, perhaps Lebanon and Taiwan Straits, lines 7 and 8, to ones such as the Middle Eastern conflict or countering Soviet influence in the Indian Ocean, or war at sea, or the resolution of conflicts growing out of the struggle for control of ocean resources, where the relevant power, as in Europe and Asia for the 70s and 80s, shifts for a greater need for maritime power, including marines. Now, on chart 8, I summarize the reasons for this shift to the right toward a greater emphasis on maritime power. You'll recall, Mr. President, with regard to that last one, that when you visited the Sixth Fleet, you commented on the great utility of the Navy and Marine task forces there. And on slide 9, you'll recall being briefed by General Birchnell as to how General Goodpaster would have proposed to bring U.S. troops in to back up the Navy and Marines. Since then, by congressional action, as Admiral Moore indicated, Greece is being offended. And the net result is that in a non-NATO crisis in the Mediterranean, land-based ground and air are increasingly not relevant. Now, what is the military situation? Chart 10. I'll compare the U.S. and the Soviet forces and discuss how we've allocated them. With regard to chart 11, Admiral Moore has discussed those, and I'll just point out that in the slide on the right, or the graph on the right, a significant fraction of that MIRV increase is due to the Polaris Poseidon. Those forces, in essence, represent the pre-strike lineup. Now, on chart number 12, I show you
I ask one question. Poseidon is working well.
Yes, sir.
The first three have deployed. They're highly reliable. The tested off. Looked like a real beauty. In fact, the only positive thing on all the why is it that the Soviet isn't interested in stopping MIRV?
They've got that huge SS-9.
They have a tremendous throw weight in the SS-9, which they put a hell of a lot of MIRVs up on top of it.
Because they're behind us.
Just a matter of fact.
Like they want to develop the capability too. They figured that we...
They're already in the development program.
No doubt about it. They're going...
They may be MIRV already, you think?
No,
we don't know for sure.
Well, we think they probably have multiple re-entry vehicles on USS-9, but I don't like to get into the debate of whether they're independently targeted or not, but they will have that capability, Mr. President, in the 1972-73 time period.
Let me ask Dave a question. Dave, looking at this from the scientist over, we've been around the track on ABM and so forth, but you can see that it's rather interesting that there's always these issues that stir the people up. It's hard to realize it. About a year ago, 18 months ago, MIRV, what is winning about MIRV? You know, we got to stop MIRV. What do you think of MIRV? Would you say it's almost indispensable to you? A view of the fact that we have so much to throw away, the advantage that we have, whatever advantage that we have, has got to be maintained by the MIRV. Both sides. Now, this is one place where we ought to do better.
correct, Mr. Cadet. That's the place where research and development, R&D, not only R&D, but application and so forth, and technological breakthroughs may be the answer.
Increased accuracy?
No answer. Increased accuracy is the...
Exactly.
One of the things I talk about, these huge weapons, and but one that is, after all, the bang of one-tenth of a Polaris is a hell of a bang,
right?
Trying to get attacked.
If it's accurate, it can be made.
It's like hitting with a shotgun or a rifle. A shotgun may scar a guy up pretty good, but the rifle pierces his heart.
But you run into the people who are playing. Look, you're improving the accuracy. It gives you a first strike capability.
Naval base construction at Mersa Matruh, just next to the Libyan border, a Soviet base,
totally under Soviet possession, 15-year base rights to air and sea bases, and then the most uncertainty. Chart number 17 shows you the ship base.
And how any major country like the United States could allow a sinking election in Moldova be lost, Mellis?
One vote. One member of parliament who apparently won about 10 votes.
We must have a brilliant ambassador there. Go
ahead. Chart number 17, the ship days in the Indian Ocean continue to go up for the Soviets and level for us. Chart number 18 shows you my forecast of the picture 10 years from now. Chart number 18 shows you a situation in which we vary all the way from complete communist orientation in Yemen and Somalia and Egypt.
Go ahead.
To one where they've just begun their nibbling, as in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, and in Ceylon, where they just moved in to help with the insurgency. They've taken the first three of the salami slices in Mauritius. But in 10 years, their medium bombers and their ships operating in those circles will control the Indian Ocean with present trends. Chart number 19 is probably the most important chart in the book, Mr. President, because it shows you the situation for 1975 as it has been perceived each year since 1967. Take column A, for example, missile-equipped ships. In 1967, our intelligence community said that in 75, there would be 58 of them in Soviet possession. By 1968, we had to revise upward to 77, and so on. So that by 71, as we have gotten closer to 75, we see that we had to increase our estimate by 57%. In the case of the other categories, 26% and 24%, and only in the case of conventional subs have we been overestimating. Well, now, what has been our response to that, sir? It's been just the reverse. Here is our plan for 1975 during each of one of those years. Let's take a look at one of great concern to General Chapman, column B. In 1967, our plan for 1975 in amphibious ships was 137 ships. By 1968, we had reduced that plan for 1975 to 99 ships. By 1971, the budget year being presented, we will be down to 41% of what our original plan was. So in response to each perceived increase for the year 1975, we have reduced our forces. Now, that's made clear in terms of the impact on chart number 21. So I compare a pre-war year, 1965, on the left-hand side, with what you will get in the 73 budget on the right-hand side. A 43% reduction in ships, a 21% reduction in aircraft squadrons, a 15% reduction in military personnel. Only in the case of the shore establishment, civilian personnel, have we failed to take a reduction. In my judgment, we need to make major reductions there in order to pick up some of the badly needed money to keep ships and aircraft operating. On chart number 22, I let you see the net effect of our new initiatives and the force reduction. This shows you what the Navy can do for you. This is looking at a $79.6 billion defense budget with regard to that last problem, the 1 in 5 chance. Before I tell you what we can't do, let me talk about those odds. Over on page 23, I show you that I consider myself to be your Jimmy DeGreek. Jimmy DeGreek, on the left-hand side, does these two things. He makes an analysis of contestants' capabilities. He looks at the past performance of their teams. He looks at recent injuries or personnel changes. And then he uses his relevant experience to integrate it in his mind, and he comes up with odds. Before I relieved Tom Moore, I did the same thing. And I had come up with odds using my relevant experience. And I show them to you on the chart number 24. The day I relieved him, I felt we had about a 55% confidence level, and we proved our deterrence during the subsequent Jordanian crisis. By this last June, we were down to 45%. By the end of next June, we will be down to 35%. I told you 30% a year ago, but you added some chips back in, and that kicked us back up. Deterrence is hazarded at that level. With the budget you're being presented, 20%, 1 in 5, great risk of deterrence. If the reputed $76 billion budget comes across, I say don't gamble at all. Now on chart 25, I show you what we could do in a NATO conflict at various points in time. In 1970, with the forces you had, you could have met the NATO commitments, provided with your Navy tactical air assistance in Central Europe, supported the NATO flanks with Navy air and amphibious forces, and we could have kept the sea lanes open with losses. By 1971, it was marginal. by 1972, it was still worthless, less within the five criteria there. And by 1973, with the budget you presented, I believe we cannot resist Soviet power in the Pacific. We cannot control the Med. We cannot provide any tactical air to NATO because we've got to concentrate our remaining carriers on controlling the sea lines in the center of the Atlantic and Pacific. And we cannot guarantee the outcome. Now, what are your Navy capabilities in the early 70s for a non-NATO war at sea with the Soviet Union, such as might eventuate over South Korea or over Israel? In 1970, we could have backed up the unilateral guarantee. By 1971, largely bluffed. By 1972, we cannot, in my judgment, guarantee either of those, or Japan. By 1973, we can't come to the assistance of Japan. I believe we have to abandon the Mediterranean and Western Pacific and concentrate on defense of the continental U.S., Alaska, and Hawaii. Now, my recapitulation, then, I'll just ask you to read.
What page?
Page on chart 27. Nuclear stalemate. Future contingencies more likely to be at the type of which naval power is relevant. And that result, finally, is the relevant power is or soon will be held by the Soviet Union both for war fighting and crisis management. Now, what should our relative military priorities be? On chart 28, I show you, obviously we have to have some in each category. Strategic has to come first. We've got to be able to control the sea to get into the game. And the sea control forces, once you have control of the sea, can swing over to projecting their power inland, including the Marines, and then come to the support of our indigenous allies, land-based air and ground forces, or put U.S. forces in if required. Why this priority ordering on chart number 29? I'd like to emphasize the second point. Even after the completion of the very fine C-5A aircraft procurement, 94% of the millions of tons that have to go to support our forces or our allies' forces have got to go on the surface of the seas, even the aviation gasoline necessary to bring those aircraft home. Now, sea control further guarantees the survivability of the most important part of our strategic deterrent. In a conventional war, if we don't have control of the sea, the Soviets can grind down those missile submarines and then strike first. Only at sea might we have to go completely alone. Wherever else we're fighting overseas, per se, we've got allies with us. On chart number 30, I summarize what our priorities, I believe, need to be. A minimum program to provide new relevant power for the 70s. Now, I'll enlarge on each of those in the final three slides. With regard to for the future, chart number 31, I am asking, Mr. President, that you add to the Navy share of the $79.6 billion, $102 million outlays for new ships, $160 million in outlays for new aircraft. Among other things, in addition to continuing our existing programs, it will permit us to go for a nuclear carrier this year, which I think is terribly important in terms of the signal it sends, and every 3 years to keep a minimal force of 12 for a 36-year life, one nuclear frigate every year, and 100 of these small craft, which will reduce the average cost of our ships. For the present, I'm asking that you add to the Navy share of $79.6 billion enough money to retain at least the 107 ships scheduled to go out in the present budget. This will cost $905 million in operating and maintenance, and $125 million in other procurement, and I'm urging that we get base closure authority to pick up the additional money that we would need. Now, if we got all that, the Navy fraction of the budget would go from 27.4% to 28.7%. Chart number 32, I talk about how we can increase our capability by employment of forces. We need to home port overseas, conventional carrier task forces. This will let us do with a lesser number of carriers as we come down with mirrors what we're now doing with a larger number of carriers. It improves our posture overseas and gives us a capability to reinforce with two more carriers than we could otherwise reinforce with if we hadn't home ported. And it improves the retention of our personnel. Now, to back these conventional carrier task forces up, we need the two nuclear carrier task forces on the continental coast of the United States in each ocean. The fourth nuclear carrier we're asking for this year would give us that capability. On slide number 33, I try to sum all this up by correlating what I believe you are trying to do with what I believe to be the relevant maritime power required to do it. I list in column A on the left your new initiatives. I believe that in order for the outcome of these initiatives, deteriorating probabilities of success over in the black column C, which I've plotted over a four budget year period. Now these expectations of war outcome mean far more than just a theoretical war with the Soviet Union. Note the use of the word expectation. The Kremlin is doing similar calculations. The naval odds makers in NATO are doing similar calculations. I spoke of my recent trip where the NATO nations, Spain and Sweden, are clearly doing these kinds of calculations. What this means is that the whole ambiente within which you're trying to accomplish your initiative is being changed rapidly. The temptation for the Soviets to hold out for a better and better deal on SALT, and the pressures on you to settle for a lesser and lesser deal on SALT and MBFR and in the Mideast are getting greater. There is a decreasing inclination on the part of Moscow and Peking with this 73 budget to work with us to resolve the conflict in Southeast Asia or to follow up on any initiative you take after your trip to Communist China. There will be continued erosion of the NATO flanks, which is where NATO is being broken up, one arm at a time. If the 73 budget is not increased for the Navy, Mr. President, in my judgment, you'll find an increasing percentage of your time in the middle column, in the crisis management section. Not only will you be in it more often, but the circumstances under which you will have to resolve it will be increasingly less favorable, because you will face the alternative of losing the war if you carry out beyond the bluff stage. I urge, therefore, that the $1.3 billion in expenditures be added in order to drive us back up in that black, closer to the 50% line, in order that you will have the minimum capability to accomplish your new initiatives and not spend your time in the crisis management period. Now, the final slide, chart number 34, Mr. President, tells me that you have integrated all this very much as Jimmy DeGree in your mind, because you gave this in an off-the-cuff press conference a year and a month ago. This says to me that you're aware of the fact that the tremendous ground forces of China do represent a certain deterrent in NATO center, and that $1.3 billion that I'm asking for is more than just a linchpin to add force levels to the Navy or hold force levels to the Navy. It is what will provide to our allies the reassurance that we will control the seas, that we can bring naval airstrikes up on the flanks, that we will have the amphibious power to get there to help them, so that such countries as Turkey and Greece will continue to control the Dardanelles for us, such countries as Denmark will control the Baltic, and such countries as Norway and Iceland will continue to help us control the GIUK gas. Thank you.
Now we go to the Marines. From this president, I'll be very brief.
Is he still around, the Marines?
I said earlier, but we cut them out.
Yes.
Well, as a matter of fact, we're in pretty good shape, actually. Three main divisions, three wings, 40. As of currently, we are out of Vietnam. All the main combat units are out. We deactivated the several temporary wartime units, and we're down very close to our full peacetime strength, which is 206,000. And that's enough to man the three division wing teams in an excellent strength. The three divisions and wing are all back at their home bases, and we've resumed our traditional role of force and readiness. We come out of Vietnam with new and modern equipment, both air and ground. We've been successful in re-equipping. It was very modernized. General, what's wrong with you? Did we learn something from Vietnam? Each war is supposed to teach us something.
Yeah. So, Mr. President,
I mean, in terms of the new and modern equipment thing was interesting.
Yeah.
So the Army and the Air Force, we learned a few things.
The helicopter became of age.
Yeah.
We were able to introduce electronics on the battlefield to improve our intelligence.
Of course, it's a special kind of war, I suppose. That's why you didn't learn a hell of a lot about the war with the Soviet, but you might have learned something. We might have learned something about other things.
Well, I think a lot of lessons learned transferable to
you do want Western Europe.
Oh, yes, sir.
Definitely. We had a little practice.
Yes, sir. It's an important point. Combat experience. One of the points I wanted to make about the Marine Corps, we have come out of Vietnam with a tremendous reservoir of that priceless ingredient, combat experience. So it's the another market dweller, I might just say in passing that I think our biggest problem now is learning how to use all this in the year we have. And we've certainly got our best air and ground. We've got a major effort going on. Currently, we have two-thirds of a division and two-thirds of a wing on Okinawa and even put in Japan. They're forward deploying and they're fully combat ready. We have a division and wing on the East Coast in the Carolinas and they're ready. Division of Conlon and the wing at El Toro and the other third of the Westpac outfit, which is at Hawaii, they're not fully ready now. They have all their supplies and equipment, but they just came out of Vietnam. And it's going to be another 2-3 months before we get fully combat ready. We've got all the necessary resources, we've got enough work, it's just a question of distributing them, shaking them down, getting this squared away. In an emergency between now and that point, we could strip the rest of the Marine Corps and build them up in a matter of a few days and have that one of the 3rd Division Wing team fully ready. With regard to the Reserve Division Wing, the Reserve, they're fully ready. They can mobilize and deploy for combat in 60 days. However, I might point out that we saw some handwriting on the wall in the month of July. We made only 55% of our reserve recruiting quota. That question. Personally, 55%, yes, sir, during the month of July. We made our active duty quotas very close. Well, they were hard, but the reserve,
we used 55%.
We used the pool,
yeah.
And we had some other else. I've personally verified our state of residence during recent trips, particularly the Western Pacific. So I assure you that we're in good shape and ready to fight. Our biggest problem is that the Navy doesn't have the amphibious ships
sticking together there.
It's only by pooling all the amphibious ships in one ocean that it's sufficient for one big wing team put together. Turning then to FY73, our portion of the 789.6 billion will require us to reduce about 20,000 Marines from 206 to 186. As a result, we'll have to carry 27 rifle companies, that's one per battalion, and carry some 128 operational aircraft, both fixed wing and helicopters. And these are reductions we've cut into our muscle. And that's where, of course, is where the fighting is done by the rifle companies with supporting aircraft. It'll cost $178 million to restore those 20,000 Marines and the 27 rifle companies in the aircraft. That's relatively few dollars for a considerable amount of combat power. But in any event, the spread, and I can assure you that we're ready, even though each battalion would be in 73 under the 79.6, would be reduced by one company and its supporting aircraft. Three divisions and wings do constitute a powerful air ground forces that are suitably disposed. These forces are, and they will be, fully prepared on short notice to go wherever the President requires with the Navy and conduct a full spectrum of operations or put it more bluntly into fight.
Mel, could I ask one thing to be done earlier? Connelly's going off, going to Texas, I think, today or something has to go up. In terms of the budget discussions that are going on, Connelly and Schultz are the two that I'd like to have hear this briefing just as they gave it here.
Yeah, the Navy briefing, Schultz and the
Schultz and
the Navy.
Well, could you arrange it? Well, I know it's hard to get this group together, but I think if those two particularly, there are others that have had it, you see, if they don't have to sit and talk on that budget challenge. I mean, George Schultz has got the budget. Could you arrange to have the two of them get it, sit here and get the same briefing that you can? Could you do that? I think they know you all get together to do it. I think it's very important. I'd like to have them have that before. Might be arranging today. Or could you? This is, I know he has to leave, but I'd like to catch him before. Well, why don't you, if necessary, even
that's what I mean. The state has got it in other ways.
As far as facilities, the show thing?
Well, much of it is.
Well, maybe he's got it ready too, but
I think Conley's the one I think you could really have.
Conley has.
He needs to have it so that he just doesn't approach us from the standpoint of
the money.
What'd you say?
He can be taken care of.
Good.
Anytime, say.
Well, we work on it. Work on it at the time. Do it, shoot, actually do it, practically an hour. I want them to be the same frame of reference as the rest of us, the three of us. I want all of them to have the same frame of reference when we talk about the defense budget. You see my point?
Yes.
Good that I should do that.
Good.
If you can. The other point that it needs to be made is two other points. One, referring to what Admiral Simon has said about the credibility of NATO and the credibility of the Soviet Union. I think more important here, though, at this point is the Soviet isn't about to jump us any more than we're about to jump them. No. More important here, though, is what it means to such jackass places as India, frankly, Japan, the Mid-Eastern area, Latin America, and the rest. The real big question we've been facing here for the last 3 years since we've been here is whether the United States can have an effective foreign policy. Nixon doctrine and all that sort of thing. Come on, others should have done. Can we have an effective foreign policy and not have what a credible defense posture? Now, there are many that think we can. It's a great question in my mind, but we can. I'm not referring to a credible defense posture with regard to Soviet China. That can be handled, although Henry, I would say that the Chinese wouldn't about be interested in having talks with a power that they thought was not going to be around 3-4 years from now. It's an incredible power against the Soviets. That's what we have to be present in the West and Pacific. Now Japan, the same problem. And the Japanese are practically pathological at the moment, I would say.
Right.
As to which way to turn, wondering. It isn't a question just of withdrawal from Vietnam, which is happening, and withdrawing from Asia and so forth and others. That's fine. And this is where the presence, the appearance, is so important. It's just vitally important. I'd add one other thing before the Vice President makes his comment. With regard to the Navy, I've been reading some rather disturbing stuff when I was talking to David, who was out there in the Sixth Fleet and so on. I get with regard to the Navy is our real problem is not the numbers of ships and so forth and so on, but the fact that the Soviet Navy is leading out the submarines and so forth. Their certain ships are modern, awesome, effective weapons. And now it is like they're cruisers with apparently some sort of
They have missiles that
we do not have.
Because Dave was just out there.
Yeah,
what about that?
Well, I'm going to say a word on that, Mr. President, because it is an important issue, right there. For whatever the reason, our capability has not been as good as it should have been. But we have steps underway, both defensive capability and offensive capability, to make up this difference. And I think
we have.
Done an excellent job of pulling this together. And that is an important issue. And it's, in my view, it's more important that we keep up that effort than we add additional ships or get some of these ships back. But some of these ships are old World War II ships that are not capable in relation to the Russian modern ships. And it's extremely important that we keep the efforts that are now underway develop a defense against these surface-to-surface missiles that the Soviets have, and to develop our own ability with surface-to-surface missiles. And this program, I'm satisfied, is going along about as well as it could be. And we have a significant effort included in the 73 budget for that work.
Thank you.
president, as you know, I've been in the Pacific three times in the past 2 years, and I've had a chance to talk to a lot of our friends there. It's important to this point of diplomatic credibility that you've been so occupied with is underscored in importance over there. And the real test of diplomatic credibility may not come with the larger and more potent nations, because what a Lee Kuan Yew does when he talks around the world, what the Thai do, or some lesser country, often affects the intelligence evaluations of the great powers. And I'm afraid I have to report to you that based on my conversations that I've had over there, there's a feeling that we are losing diplomatic credibility. I don't believe that these friends of ours really think that the path we're going can allow us to maintain a credible deterrent in their minds, and as they reflect this in their conversations around the world, it has to be an ingredient in the intelligence evaluation of our potential enemies. And this disturbs me greatly, because some of these people look at you and say, the Nixon doctrine, well, we understand you're just getting out of this. Prime Minister Lee is one of those very frank people who says, well, we know you're going there. Don't tell me you're going to stay around.
Well, Mr. President, I got the same thing, almost the same comment you just made quite a time ago from Prime Minister Sato when I was in, I visited him in Japan in January, and then from Franco when I was in Spain. And, what the bank president said, I think, is it?
I got it from Franco.
What is what we're doing, and I think we just might as well come right out and say it. I know it's hard for some people to say it, but I just continue to say that we're going to maintain our presence in Asia, and you can get a lot of help for doing it, but you've got to be for maintaining, and that's what the next action is all about. We're not going to back out of Asia.
To put them at the budgetary levels, they don't believe it. But,
see, now let me ask you a question.
Very disturbed about the Soviet presence in the Indian Ocean. And look at committees, it's just,
you talk about the Jordanian crisis.
Okay, we did with that little, we had ships and so forth, but you know, Maryland, anybody, 11.
We can talk all the ones at present.
Oh, all right, credit.
But, you know,
I am a great believer in the importance of sea power and demonstrated, but if we move out all our visible ground presence out of the Pacific, we are not going to convince anybody that we are going to do it with sea power.
Well, we've already done that, though.
Well, there, if we continue what we're doing, we cannot do it with mirrors. If the Japanese see us getting out of Korea, this Korea pointed at them, if all the sense between an aggressor is that we might or might not intervene with sea power, then in the judgment of the people there, we'll never probably get a chance to make the test because they'll adjust to it. So I would think that we need a balance between some physical ground presence and all the sea lift and carrier presence that everybody's talking about. But I don't think we can do it with sea power alone.
Well, I think you have to have air power too, Henry, but we've already made the decision on the land forces. We're already down to one division as far as the Marines are concerned, forward deployed, and we don't have the capability of more than one and a third as far as the Army is concerned right now. That's all we have.
But this is an issue that's going to come out of the NSC meeting, but if we go down to a third of the division in Korea, as some of these projections say,
well, if we go to a third of the division then you'd have to build up the full division in Hawaii.
For the Japanese, that's what they're going to have to do. There's another factor in this, and that is what we can do in air power, because if we can keep some air power in Korea, that will serve the presence at the beginning of the Mediterranean. Unless we can maintain either our friendship with the Greeks and the Turks, or maintain some air power on that side of the Mediterranean, you're not going to be able to operate there. So I think we have to look at air power as an important complement to our sea power in these areas we're involved in.
And now, Richard, even to make our commitment now, as far as Europe is concerned, I personally believe we have to keep the 13th Division force. That is related to our Asian requirement. It's related to the commitment which we already presently have as far as Europe is concerned.
Well, it's related to our ability to meet worldwide
things.
Mr. President, this discussion, particularly about the West Pacific, Japan, Okinawa, Taiwan, Philippines, and so on, I think points up to the importance of moving out as fast as we can with respect to the TTPI. I know the Ambassador Wade and Ambassador Hong Kong, I think they're very important because we might find ourselves with access only to Guam and the Mariana.
We've been here neither. The President has documents. TTPI,
we're getting those idiot Peace Corps people out there.
Well, let me say, it's a very good presentation. It's all good.
Because we have some discouraging questions. We're not all on the same side. We're kind of looking out to it. It's a tough fight. It's a tough fight in terms of the budget. And we got down to the key question. In order to get what we need, we need more access. Maybe American people are going to have to face up to that. Who knows? We may have to face up to that at some point. Because what is happening, what's eating us alive, isn't just in the services, but it's all through the government, it's personnel. The personnel costs roar out.
Mr. President, we have these other programs too, and I don't know whether we'll talk about this in the National Security Council, but we have to make assignments on other costs that I have to assign here that most people don't even understand. Not only the NRO, which is our total satellite program, which is a very important program. Some people think that somehow out of some other person's budget, I have to assign the Air Force. And I have to sign the CIA budget too. And I don't get into that normally before the National Security Council, but as you know,
all those things have to be buried in our budget. And we have to address those things that have to be hidden in our budget today, but if we don't normally, but the Air Force bears the greatest load on those assigned costs.
Well, that company says another bow.
This is the, which I see, this is the cabinet room where the president meets with the deputy president's chairman. That's why he was detained, because he had a meeting with the judges.
No, 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 no.
vice.
Yes, I said.
You know that, that you go to prison for that?
No, because I don't damage the mold. The
well,
that's
right. You say it's it.
How do you know? Faisal.
Oh, yeah, he goes. Aren't they nice? Beautiful. But you have so many pairs of couples, I don't think you want it anymore.
I don't have any.
I have a special one for the president, I'll get you.
For the president? For the president.
But I have one special for the president.
See, now, I don't have a special one for the president. I ask her one of her friends around here, but they don't give me any.
You see, he's to me my birthday 1969. He forgot my birthday.
Well, I can't wait for the event.
Thank you.
Of the matches?
Yes. Everything goes out of the
way. Yes, sir. Oh. He's coming back, I guess, that's it. Prime Minister, we went to the Academy
that room. When we came up, I went back, I left you here, and I went back into the diplomatic entrance, and he was telling us that maybe he has to cut his ship,
make the trip shorter.
He may have to go back sooner.
I'm sorry to hear that, sir.
We have a nice schedule on plane for you.
New York, Colorado.
Didn't you only have to cut Monday, surely?
Oh, I see.
Oh, well, that's not so bad.
Is that what he's going to need?
25th?
On the 20th.
On the 30th, he will be able to receive, but after that, it will be free.
I see.
What did you do in Tokyo?
On the 25th?
On the 25th, that will be free.
On the 26th?
I see.
We didn't embarrass your foreign minister and your ambassador this morning, because
I think I am. Can you
handle? Because your the meeting between the president and the prime minister was just two of them. As I told Ambassador yesterday, Ambassador Son, I said it would be just two. They would remain here at Blair House, and in the event that your president, Prime Minister or President Nixon, which he could bring the money over. But they got in the car and the bit was quite kind of confusing.
I told the Prime Minister that I'm not supposed to do it. And he
right.
I say.
Well, see, you should have told me that, because then I could have brought him over here. But Mr. McCarthy is over there. In case we run late, Mr. McCarthy, we will go direct to the press club, and Mr. McCarthy will bring them over to the press club.
Well, I just didn't want to make that weak.
I didn't want to put them in an embarrassing position.
They could wait over here just as well, but has the foreign minister been into the White House?
I went to the UCLA, I think maybe last year, he might have been. Because the ambassador has been here.
Right.
More of those for the rest of your party.
Yes.
You think they would enjoy having one?
Yeah. Right. Sorry. You have to give it a professional.
Thank you.
He would want to see the reception. You can leave the plane right there.
You can leave the
camera? You can leave it right there.
President Pompidou came with
Saturday.
We were supposed to have King Hassan of Morocco.
And when he was coming,
he was coming in May, but he had to cancel his trip. Well, not because, no, this was before the attempted assassination.
He came,
he was supposed to come in May
for,
my stomach is, I must be hungry.
he was supposed to come in May,
but he sent his Prime Minister Meraki, to apologize and ask for a postponement because of an Arab summit meeting that was taking place, which he had to be at.
He was coming over with 130 people.
You don't think that's a problem trying to move? It's not so bad. We do the car, right? The cars. Then I recruit more people. See, I have three protocol officers plus
the two secretaries who help out.
And usually in a part of this size, one protocol officer is enough and a secretary. But then I have people like Mr. Passwaters in California, who is not connected with the State Department, but is a personal friend of mine. And he does it just to help us out because he's familiar with how we like to arrange these things. And then when we go to New York, there will be another gentleman
there to help us out.
Then when we go to San Francisco, there will be another man. Because these people are personal friends of mine, and rather than me sending my protocol officer or I myself going out, I just call them on the telephone and say, we're coming with 30, 40 people, we need so many rooms, we need this, we need that, and they make all the arrangements. It makes it easier for us.
The president's that way too. He doesn't like it. You know, we're not president, right?
Yeah. But as you see, we have
quite a bit of security on our plane.
In fact, we have 11 who fly with us.
And we'll see the spot of flying.
It's me from North Bend to Bangkok.
Okay. Yes. Alexis Johnson, yes. I think he was supposed to be ambassador.
He was ambassador to Japan,
yes.
You, Alexis Johnson.
Please, relax.
Did you? Oh, they had tea here for you, but they...
That's right, how we got
it. Ambassador, did you just get enough to reach tea?
Well,
I don't know, maybe it's cold or very sorry.
It's Japan.
Well, you know, a vacation to make exercise, got some town, go fishing.
When?
I caught the shark. I caught the shark mainly weekend, and it's nothing new again.
Oh,
still big?
Yeah.
Well, mine was this big.
Oh, because you are a big shark and you go and be the ball for everybody from this yet,
you know? Oh, from the yacht, not this big yacht.
Yeah, I know.
Because I'm a big girl.
You got a shark in there. Anything else?
Two mackerels and four flounders.
I got four blues.
Over there, no blues. I mean, I'm on top.
And way out of the top.
Oh, Montauk.
Funny thing, I came home to the bank, it was a long time ago, I got my fishing rod. And this time,